The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the MadTech Podcast, hosted by me, ExchangeWire COO Lindsay Rowntree. And today joining me from ExchangeWire is our Antipodean CEO, Rachel Smith, who is sitting all the way in Australia, where it's currently 10 p.m. So she loves us right now. Rachel, how are you, apart from tired and delirious?
I feel like I need to say g'day or something after that, you know, right royally Aussie introduction.
Well, I had to make an effort, you know.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Appreciated from down here in the Southern Hemisphere, otherwise known as the future, 11 hours ahead. But it's always good to be on the MadTech Podcast.
Even at 10 p.m. at night.
Yes, exactly. So what else would you be doing before bedtime?
Well, that's very true. Yeah. Why not be on a podcast before bedtime? It'll help you sleep well. And I'm delighted to join our special guest this week, who is Max Maharaj, the CEO of digital agency Be A Bear. Welcome, Max.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me on this week.
Great to have you on. And you are London-based, but globally operated. That's right.
Yeah, we are London-based. We've got an office in LATAM as well. Unfortunately, I think it's similar really to Rachel right now. They're all telling me how nice and warm it is, whereas I'm sitting here and it's freezing cold. Like frost on the cars and you're slipping over in the street. It's awful.
Yeah, wonderful, wonderful London winter. Right, I'm going to go straight into our stories this week. We've got some good stories for you all. And the first one, obviously, is about the beginning of the cookie deprecation. So Google's plan to eradicate third-party cookies on Chrome have commenced. The first phase out began on the 4th of January, which affected 1% of users. Google haven't said how many people this affects, but the estimated number is around 30 million. That's not my number. I didn't come up with that. It's various reports around that say it's probably around 30 million people that were affected by this. So if people haven't already at least made some headway to manage the fallout of the loss of the third-party cookie, they really should be about now. At the back end of last year, we asked our global newsletter subscribers in a poll whether ad tech needed to be better prepared for the loss of the third-party cookie. The results were interesting. 55% said no, they were already ready. 32% said we're still learning. And 13% said we're going to struggle. I'm interested in your thoughts on this, Max and Rachel. And if you want to take part in or get the results of our weekly polls, you can sign up to our Daily Digest and Weekly Stack newsletters on the exchangeware.com homepage. But Max, over to you for this one first. What do you think about these poll results? Do they align with what you're seeing with your clients? How prepared are they?
It's always really easy, agency side, to say that clients haven't got a clue about some of the things going on. I think that that 13% is that same group of people who, when GA4 was rolling out last year, they were all flustered and freaking out about stuff. And I was talking to a colleague this morning about when GDPR first came out and everyone was getting very antsy about, oh God, we're going to lose all these email marketing lists. And I remember I was client side at the time and I was thinking to myself, We haven't sent an email to any of these people for the last 3 years. So like, you're going to lose them because they don't care anyway. I think we've had a lot of conversations about it. We have a weird group of clients as well, because some of our clients are media owners. And then some of our clients are brands and advertisers trying to get on those media owners. So I think for particularly the media owner ones, they're going to have to step up their game in how they talk about their audience. And there was a lot of brands moved to this model of, let's just generate as many ad units as possible. Like, let's build out the inventory and chuck loads of like dross on our websites or any of our properties, put out loads of videos to try and get more ad inventory in. And there's going to be a big shift away from that, because you now need to go back to being like, okay, this is, trying to think like a media owner that's all about cars. We're going to go back to just making really good car content and writing about cars. So then when you want to go and sell those ad units to people, you're going to sell them to people who actually like make car brands or, you know, something in that world. I think for brands, the part that I've been banging on about this to some of our clients, stop worrying about third party, start getting your own on-site, like those first party cookies, your own on-site experience really, really good. If I go to I'm such a bad example of this myself, because I try and think about what I buy, but if I'm going to go welly shopping, for example, and I go on a site and I go back to that site 2 days later, I want Wellies to be at the top of the site. I want you to show me Wellington Dukes. I'm gonna, this is such a poor example. Really bad example. It's better next time. But yeah, if I see a Welly website and they show me these at the top, then great. I can pick up where I left off rather than having to trawl through 6-7 different pages to get to where I wanted to be. So yeah, I think there's a lot, definitely a lot for the industry to still do. But I think that that 13%, although it's probably the loud one shouting about how terrible this is going to be, I don't think we're going to feel much effect.
Yeah, I think
I can see you guys nodding, so I'm hoping we're on the same page and I'm not saying anything out there.
I mean, I definitely agree with you, and Rachel, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. Do you agree with Max that it's the 13% are the ones that are kind of the flustered ones that are actually kind of going, oh no, what's going on, and actually everything's really fine, and most people have been on top of this for a long time and know what's going on? And do you think that, you know, brands and media owners, publishers alike, are being now able to be more considered in their approach to data and how they source data and how they manage and use data?
Well, I certainly hope so, is the answer to all of those questions, right? You know, it's not as though we haven't been talking about cookie deprecation for a couple of years now. It's not as though the industry hasn't been given fair warning with a couple of false starts along the way. And so I do feel like, you know, and I would also add to that over the last 12 months, I feel as though, you know, we've been writing a lot about the sorts of things that brands and advertisers in particular, also publishers, but very specifically brands and advertisers, are doing to try to prepare themselves for, you know, some kind of personalized advertising experience or marketing experience beyond deprecation of third-party cookies. So I really hope that 13% is representative of people that like to complain or want to shout the loudest about stuff that they don't like and are having a bit of a, as you say, Max, GDPR moment. But I sort of also think, though, conversely, that if you had Kieran on this call, he would say that he doesn't feel that the industry in totality is truly ready for this moment. But that is because he would like to critique some of the solutions that brands and advertisers and even publishers are starting to use and test and kind of, get a bit closer to, and say that those solutions might be good short-term options for not necessarily cookie replacement, but new ways to direct some of your marketing and advertising activity, but they might not be sustainable over the long run. And where, you know, in a sort of longer perspective, from a longer perspective, where exactly is the industry heading when it comes to personalized advertising? Are we just moving back away from one-to-one advertising because that's going to become harder and harder and more compromised? And so then what does the advertising experience look like, and what technology tools are actually helping brands and advertisers and publishers prove the value of those advertising transactions? But that's a big issue. The answer to the questions that I think that this particular article raises, and the issues that Max, or you know, or the perspectives that Max shared with us, and the further points you made, Lindsay, I do believe that the majority of smart marketers, brands and agencies, and also publishers, have been working really hard to try to make their businesses focused on first-party data. So either the gathering of first-party data or the use and application of first-party data, they cannot have missed the importance of that message. We've been talking about it for years. It would be astounding to discover a big proportion of people that are literally going, I haven't noticed, or this is going to be a big drama and I don't know what I'm doing. You know, we've been going on about this for quite some time.
Yeah, it's down to what Max said about GDPR first coming out and everyone going, oh no, no, we can't email these people. It's like, well, you never did in the first place, so why is it a big deal? I mean, Max,
I think that's a really important point.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I was just going to add to that. It's a really important point, Lindsay, because I think that the bigger issue here is not you know, the existence or disappearance of third-party cookies, because we should just be accepting that they're not going to be a usable tool, and rather how are we finding audiences that brands and marketers want to advertise to? How are publishers making those audiences discoverable? And, you know, what are the tools that we're using to make that work, and what metrics are we using to prove the value of that transaction?
Yeah, totally. And Max, from your perspective, you know, with working with, as you mentioned, kind of marketers and media owners, what is the focus for you? Like, does this consume a lot of your day? as a company, with your different various teams, or actually are there kind of much more interesting things going on and this doesn't really kind of get on the radar because it's all been sort of sorted a long time ago?
I think it has been sorted quite a while, not quite a while ago, but it's because it's been that kind of background noise for a while, it's not a massive concern. I think that a lot of the strategy that we, not a lot of the strategy, every project obviously has its own kind of strategy, but one drum that we bang on a lot about is understanding audiences. And I think that's for, I'm going to use an example, I use it all the time. Marks and Spencer's sell bras, right? They sell women's underwear. I am not the target audience for Marks and Spencer's. But if I see a Marks and Spencer's billboard, I know that that's what they sell. Like that's one of the items that they sell. So if someone says to me, oh, can you recommend a bra? I'd be like, well, I think Marks and Spencer's, because they clearly are everywhere around this, because that's how the audience, like I'm part of that total audience. I think we're going to see a shift to display where a lot more brands are in relevant places. Now, whether that's against news sites or entertainment websites where their display ads are sitting in the right space. And they might not all be fantastic. Like, I don't know, maybe I don't want to buy a Lotus, but if there's a Lotus advert there all the time, I'm going to know that Lotus now associates with that brand. They're buying space there. So they maybe it's the sort of thing in the world that I might say 6 months later to someone, oh, Lotus have a new car out because I've seen an advert about it. I don't feel kind of roundabout way to answer the question. I don't feel like it's something that we're putting front and center because it's been background noise and it's been accepted.
Yeah. So it's almost as though it's kind of fundamental to the way that you're undertaking marketing and advertising campaigns, right? And then presumably you're working with your clients and testing a whole manner of tools that they might want to use to either improve their first-party data capabilities or improve their exactly that audience transaction, how they find those audiences.
Yeah, and I don't think they're going to be chucking the same amount of money into like maybe digital display ads, and it might be things that they go, oh, cool, we'll put more towards social, or we'll put more to, maybe there will be a turn back to like people spending more money on out of home, which would be great. Good billboards, show-stopping moments are great. But I think we'll probably see more money going into social. And I know you guys have probably discussed this in the past. Like TikTok's a really good marketplace right now. If you want to go and start buying inventory there as well, it's relatively cost effective. So yeah, maybe there will be a shift in there will be a shift. I'm going to be very definitive on that. There's going to be a shift to more money spent on social.
Yeah,
that's very interesting.
Sort of further to your welly example there as well, Max. I just think that's
a terrible example.
No,
wellies and bras. That's what I'm good at, apparently.
Yeah,
wellies and bras. And
I've just got to say, neither of those things are sort of immediately obvious when I'm looking at you on this on this Zoom call. You're not in the countryside. You don't appear to be. Let's move on. But the wellies example, though, makes me think about how we want to experience, how the average user wants to experience advertising these days. I mean, it's long been accepted that the kind of world of creepy targeted ads is low quality and low value for everybody involved. However, we do want to be able to surface and find the products that are relevant to our lives, particularly when we may already be acquisitive and be moving around the internet looking for those products. So I just think that actually, if we think of it from more of a macro view, it's about time that cookies disappeared, made creepy advertising less possible, and pushed us into a world where we've got a better chance of finding things more conveniently, right? And accepting that value transaction, which is I get to consume free content on the internet because advertising pays for it.
Round of applause, well said. On that note, I'm going to move us on to our second story, which is about Eurostar. And the UK watchdog has ruled that Eurostar's £39 seat sale advert was misleading. And for anyone who may not know what Eurostar is, there's a giant tunnel in between England and France, and Eurostar runs high-speed trains from between London and Paris, Brussels, Lille. But it's anyway, it's a very popular way of getting between England and France, frankly. And it's had a bit of a disaster over the past kind of few weeks with various
issues.
It
certainly has.
It really, really has. But anyway, they are one of the latest companies to be censured by the Advertising Standards Authority, the ASA, for an ad misleading consumers about the cost of seats during its sale last summer. The company's ads claim that customers could purchase seats from £39 each way. However, only a very small percentage of tickets were available at that price. The advertising watchdog warned Eurostar not to make similar price claims in the future. So they claimed that they made 39,000 seats available at that price, and they made it completely clear in their terms and conditions that was what the availability was. But something like 20 million people travel on the Eurostar each year, which equates to about 55,000 people per day. So offering seats at that price for fewer than one day of the travel doesn't seem like a particularly good deal to me. It seems like an incredibly small percentage. Anyway, like I just alluded to, they've not had the best time of it recently. They had to cancel 40 services over Christmas and New Year due to many things like staff strikes and tunnel flooding. Not the tunnel under the sea, thankfully, but one under the Thames. I didn't even know it went under the Thames, but whatever. Which affected the travel plans of 30,000 passengers over the busiest travel days of the year. And it highlighted massively the lack of consumer rights for rail passengers versus air passengers. I mean, I digress. That's not relevant to what we're talking about now, but it's just very interesting. And anyway, you must both have experienced getting an email offer or seeing an offer about in a display ad or whatever from companies like Eurostar. There's many more that can come to mind. Maybe you'll share a few examples yourselves, where they're promoting super low prices and you then go to try and get those prices and you cannot see them absolutely anywhere. Or if you can, it's you've got to sit on the wing of the plane or something. So I want to understand if you think that we'll be seeing more crackdowns from the ASA in the UK and other authorities in, across the world for things like that. Surely this is damaging to brands. Why do they continue to do it? Rachel, I'm going to come to you first and your thoughts on this one.
Well, I think it's really interesting. The answer to the question, you know, do I think that we're going to see more complaints like this come forward? Well, this was a consumer complaint, right? That
it
went
was.
To the Advertising Standards Authority. I'd love to see the rundown of the average consumer complaint because, I mean, I concur in that. When have you ever received an email like that, jumped online and actually got the fare at that price? Now, I reckon I probably have at times, and I think I probably have traveling on the Eurostar too. You know, I used to, one of my best friends from school lives in Paris. I used to travel between London and Paris on the Eurostar really frequently and used to get some really good deal prices and would often act on the back of an offer, you know, because he lived there so I could travel there flexibly and choose dates that would mean that I'd get a good offer, right? But I still feel like it's part and parcel of our consumer lives that we very often get bombarded with these offers and it takes you to the site. It makes you think about booking a Ryanair flight. Next thing you know, even if you do find an offer at that price, there's all sorts of other things going on, like you have to pay to actually then get on the plane, it feels like these days. You have to pay to carry on. You have to pay to breathe on the plane. And, you know, I mean, at what point is that false advertising? I'm being a bit contrary here because I do understand that once you look at the figures, that was a very sketchy promotion offer because it didn't equate to very many seats in an enormous, you know, target audience. But will the Advertising Standard Authorities get more complaints like this? I'm not sure. I feel like articles like this could definitely encourage people to put more complaints forward.
That's
because
what
you
I
would
think.
Never have thought that they would take it seriously. This just feels like the murky world of travel advertising, where they're always putting an offer in front of you that you very rarely manage to actually book a holiday or a flight or a train or a bus or whatever at that price. And then on a serious note, that did make me think that people are much more aware, and I've been saying this about a number of issues in our industry, people are much, much more aware of the information that they receive either through email, in targeted marketing campaigns now than they ever were before. And maybe they will start paying attention to the validity of these offers or otherwise. And maybe all the staff at the Advertising Standards Authority are going to be like, oh my God, this job used to be really easy and now it's become like 10 times more difficult because everyone's complaining. And then in answer to your final point, isn't this a bad thing for brands? 100%. Brands have got a much harder time, I think, now than ever before to stay relevant in the market. Now, Eurostar, fantastic brand, but also very unique service. They don't have very many competitors, right? So they can kind of get away with whatever they want. But still, people will start making decisions, especially those that got caught up in that tunnel flooding incident a couple of weeks ago, will start making decisions about whether they'll bother taking the train if it's going to be expensive or too much of a hassle, and instead they'll get a flight. So yeah, brands beware. You can't make half-hearted offers anymore. People are far too sensitive to that these days, I reckon.
I think you're right. It makes me think of Ofcom as well in the UK. And you know, it used to be that to complain to Ofcom about something you've seen on TV that offended you or you thought wasn't right, you had to like write a letter or call them or fill in something really complicated and send it off to them. Now you can just, I think, tweet them or whatever or fill in kind of some arbitrary form. So it used to go from a complaint would have like, there'd be a, have like 10 complaints. Now it's like 30,000 complaints. And just the vast swathe in between is just absolutely crazy. And now Love Island gets about 30,000 complaints per minute for every episode that's watched. And I wonder if, kind of, you know, if authorities like the ASA make complaining easier and these kind of articles, this is from The Guardian, this particular article, get more traction and people go, yes, actually, I see this kind of stuff all the time. I'm going to start complaining and it's going to make this a thing. And the ASA will go, oh my God, this is just not worth my time. We're not staffed enough for this. But Max, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. And, you must come across these challenges when your clients have offers. And do these kind of articles kind of put more pressure on you to ensure that you're really kind of like, you know, belt and braces approach to how you are communicating to potential consumers?
I think it's articles like this, and then you've got a client who's reading like the next 3 months worth of email strategy plans and stuff. And they're like, oh, can we say this? Can we say this? Can we say that? Really quickly, can I just take a moment? If anyone from the ASA is like listening or hears this, can you just reach out to me on LinkedIn? Because I really want to know what you guys do for the rest of the year. Like, I have no concept of like, I just want to know what a day at the ASA is like. Like, do they all go to work? Like, is it hybrid? Do they have free tea and coffee? Like, what's happening there? I'm sure you're all lovely people. And please stop sending us letters. So the thing that like jumped out, I looked at this and I wrote a note and it just says eek. This was an email, wasn't it?
It was an email promotion.
So back to the numbers here. There was like 30, I think there was 39,000, I might be wrong, some 39,000 seats. There was then only 9,500 available when the email went out.
That's correct, yes.
That's correct. Cool. So there's 9,500 seats. Like, firstly, how big is the actual email marketing list? Who's opted in?
Very true.
Back to our GDPR thing, because I'm fairly certain I was on that list and I've opted out at some point. So what's the actual percentage? Maybe it is a very small percentage, but are we looking at like 5% of available seats there? Like, I don't think, when I looked at the ASA site, I didn't see the amount that was, it didn't say how many seats were actually available. There was only one complaint made about it as well that's kind of boiled all this. That seemed a little bit of a mountain out of a molehill. It's not like we had 20 or 30 complaints going in. But then also the question that, and someone please, if you know this, tell me, how long after the email did that complaint go in? Like, when did they, because sometimes I don't open marketing emails for 2 weeks. So if I've gone on, if I see something that says, flight to Paris for £100, and I click on that email 2 weeks later and I can't buy the flight to Paris, that's kind of on me. It made me think about two other campaigns in this space. There was a great print campaign a few years ago for Norwegian, before, I think Norwegian went bust and has become Norse now, but it was after Brad and Angelina broke up. And it said, Brad is single, flights to LA for $399. And they just had this on like the front page of the Metro or the Evening Standard or something. And I was like, brilliant. That's really fast, really reactive, really, really smart. And it kind of had a little bit of virality around that. It was a really, really cool campaign. But that obviously didn't get, maybe this is, as you mentioned a minute ago, maybe this is to do with airlines having different kind of rules or criteria versus train travel and then not having the same, having to adhere to the same, sort of play by the same game. But the other thing that this brings up is, what about concert tickets or theatre tickets? Because I quite often will try and buy tickets to something and yeah, maybe you can get Hamilton tickets for £39. But then also every time you go on the website, you can get them for £39 with restricted views and you're right at the back and you've got to book it in like April 2028 or something like that. So where's like, how are those guys getting away with still sending those sorts of messages? So yeah, it's a frustrating story, because I'm sure more clients have probably spoken to their account managers recently and said, are we allowed to say this? Should we be saying this? But it also doesn't feel like it really should have happened. I don't think, from what I can see, I don't know if that's an unfair email to send out. I don't know when that person opened that message. It's not like it was a billboard campaign or a display campaign that's running for ages.
No, that's true. And that is, I think, one of the comebacks that Eurostar had to the ASA was, well, actually, it could have been that he opened the email long after the offer had ended, and that's why he couldn't find anything at that price. Or I think he found maybe one seat at that price or something. I'm not sure what it was. But it does, like, you do actually remind me, talking of tickets, I was looking for tickets for the theatre the other day, and it said prices from £42. And I went into it, and the cheapest price I could get was £85. And I was like, because all the £42 seats had long gone. And it does make you think that brands need to be more on top of making sure they're updating their messaging. And if those prices do go, they shouldn't be promoting them because they're not available, haven't been for a long time. So hopefully, there's two sides to it, right? That on the one side, it should be brands need to make sure they are hot on these things, because apparently people can complain about anything and the ASA will come and clamp down on it. But also, just to not damage your brand and not frustrate your consumer and not make them kind of think, well, I'll think twice before going back to that company again, it's important that we do ensure that messaging is consistent across everything and as realistic as it can be.
I remember I met someone, and I can never remember the name of the company, and it was a really, really cool tech company a few years ago that essentially was an email. It was like a Klaviyo or a MailChimp, but they had features that you could like adjust in the email. So like, for example, you could have the weather. So depending on the IP of where someone had opened the email, it would show them their local weather. If you could have something like that that had some actual pricing, but obviously the subject line is always going to be the hard one. That's what we've got to capture attention with, that subject line. If you had something like that, and maybe in the world of GPTs, like maybe this is going to come true sooner than we hope. But I think, if you could have any way to change it, that would be like the dream. Whoever's listening to this feeling entrepreneurial, develop that, and I'll sign up.
I think I will as well.
Maybe it's a new job opportunity for anyone that's working in the ASA. Go and get into get into tech. Forget about advertising standards. Get into ad tech and develop.
I think it sounds too. Piece of software. It sounds like it's going to be far too busy for them to try and build a tech company.
They're about to have a rush on things.
I'm sorry, ASA.
ASA, we don't mean any of it, I promise. But you have, Max, led me wonderfully into the third story that we're going to discuss today, which is all about GPTs and OpenAI's App Store for GPTs, which will launch next week. So after its launch date was delayed in December, most likely due to the absolute mess that was the dramatic firing and rehiring of CEO Sam Altman, next week OpenAI will launch, finally, its App Store for GPTs, which stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer, if you're interested. Custom apps based on text-generating AI models that are run and by OpenAI. The store launch was initially announced in November at Dev Day, the company's first annual developer conference. And developers creating GPTs will have to review OpenAI's updated policies and GPT brand guidelines to ensure their GPTs are compliant before they're eligible to be listed in the store. You can create a GPT for almost anything, and they haven't got to require any kind of coding experience, which is interesting and means that we can all do anything. So the guys in the ASA will have no problem with this going forwards. An example given by TechCrunch, which reported this, is that a GPT trained on a collection of cookbooks, so it can answer questions on a specific recipe within the realms of those cookbooks. So you can train a GPT on anything, and you don't need to actually know what you're doing, apparently. You just go in completely blind and crack on with it. So what do we think on this? Max, I'll come to you on this one first. Should brands be rushing to get involved with this kind of thing? You know, what will be the benefit to them?
I feel like we're going down memory lane today. So do you remember before GDPR, when everyone wanted an app? Every single brand thought they needed to have an app for something. This feels like, I'm worried.
There was an encouragement.
Yeah, and I'm worried we're going to get a bunch of really, really smart ex-ASA employees who have decided to go and launch their tech companies, where their new business, there's going to be a lot of these businesses who are like, hey, guys, we're going to build you a GPT. Like, hey, any brand, like any accountancy firm, we're going to build you a GPT and charge them for it. In the same way that everyone seemed to have an app or want to have an app a few years ago. I think that I think it is definitely something agency-wide that, like, there are going to be benefits for us using this. There are things that we're going to be able to, like, trial or automate. And I was talking to another agency founder yesterday, actually, and he's in he does a lot in sports content. And he said that we'll just generate like 10 titles for YouTube videos. So at the moment, he'll use ChatGPT to give me 10 titles for YouTube videos. And then he won't use those titles. He'll use it to start the ideas or the brainstorming sessions around like what they're going to do afterwards. But it's kind of like, we don't like this. So there's a good starting point for it. Now, if there was a way for him to, I don't know, maybe have his own GPT that watches a football match and reads a transcript of commentary from football and then a bunch of articles and then spits out like, this would be interesting content off the back of it, then wicked, that guy's job just becomes a lot quicker and a lot easier. And that could be something like, as an idea, they own that little bit of IP and they can do that. They can monetize it internally. I think there's a bit of confusion at the moment as well about, and we're not going to, I'm right in thinking we're not going to know this until it's open, if there's going to be like a rev share on the GPT store as well. So if
any monetization for that matter, they haven't talked about a monetization model at all.
No, which is going to be very interesting because I'm not quite sure how that will work and, you know, what they are trying to get out of it. It'll be very interesting to watch this space on that one.
Well, I suppose the big thing they're going to get out of it is a lot more exposure and a lot more people kind of like building and breaking stuff.
And a lot more data.
Yeah. And then
enormous amount.
Use that against us.
Yeah, exactly. Off naturally. Everything's used against us in some way. Rachel, what are your thoughts on this and kind of the what's going to be definitely an oncoming rise of GPTs, the cottage industry of GPTs?
Yeah, well, very similarly to Max, it made me think actually of the early days of the iPhone. It's like Apple created this new operating system in the form of a phone, and it meant that there was an app for everything. And apps were so novel back in those early generation of iPhones and really sophisticated things that we couldn't quite in the first instance understand what we were going to use them for. And why did all sorts of websites or products or services needed an app? And then within 12 months, the conversation was about how many apps you had on your iPhone and how many screens you needed to swipe to get to those apps. And now we're sort of full circle and back to a position where actually I want less apps and I want to be able to do more things in one app and all of that sort of stuff. And yet here we are with OpenAI talking about opening up effectively an app store environment or a cottage industry for GPTs. And I had the same questions that you guys just raised, really, which is, what really is the motivation for OpenAI doing this? You know, they're talking about their desire to democratize access to GPTs and their creation of them, and I suppose presumably access to the information that they can produce and provide. But there's got to be a monetization element here somewhere, even if it's also about collecting our data, right? There has to be some kind of monetary upside for them somewhere along the line, and I'd really want to know what that is. And then the other thing is, I just feel as though the notion of, an entire kind of garden of GPTs that have got a whole range of levels of sophistication and have been built by a whole range of developers or, you know, very smart ex-employees of the ASA just kind of concerns me, because I'm like, well, what are they actually going to, what kind of information are you going to get out of these tools? Like, you know, ChatGPT within itself has become enormously sophisticated just in the last 12 months and is really impressive for lots of really straightforward basic things. But how will we know what GPTs we should be trusting and which ones we shouldn't be trusting? However, I'm also quite sure that our natural human curiosity will mean that we're just going to use more and more and more of these things in the same way that we did with apps when we got our first iPhone, which is what drove the desire for people to have an app for everything and for every brand to want an app. So I'm sure that we'll get some good stuff out of it. And your example, Max, I liked that around the content thing. You know, for example, if you're trying to produce a high volume of content, perhaps in a niche industry. And this works even for a business like Exchange Buy. I'm not saying that we would do it, but you can see where it would be attractive, right? We produce content for a niche industry. If we had a way, you know, if some of our content team had a way of ingesting higher volumes of content faster in order to produce summaries and to get some thoughts and ideas on new articles, then why wouldn't you use those tools? So I'm sure human curiosity will drive us toward them. But yeah, I don't know. I just found this all a bit, I can't get a clear read on it at the moment. And I say that being a keen ChatGPT user where I'm like, this is great. Why didn't we have this before? This is brilliant. Like the iPhone with the apps, right? So, yeah.
Rachel, as a ChatGPT user at the moment, what do you use ChatGPT for?
The thing I'm using it for are
you like your go-to tasks that you're automating right now?
I tell you, it's summarizing articles, not our own articles, other people's articles, any articles that I want to read. Summarizing information, actually, I could say. It's not just articles, but it's any information that's over a couple of paragraphs. I'm using ChatGPT to summarize it. Now, I'm not doing it with absolutely everything because I experimented with it a bit in the beginning and it gives you a certain type of summary. And if you ask it a question in a different way, it'll give you a different type of summary. So you can ask it to summarize, you know, a 1,000-word article into 5 bullet points or whatever, or into 2 paragraphs, and it'll give you slightly different versions of it. But I am using it to get through high volumes of information more quickly. And
so if someone releases a next week, if we see a like TLDR GPT, then that's you straight away signed up on there.
Basically, Rachel's got in on the action. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I use it for everything now. Like, it's actually, if I'm not buying something, it's replaced Google for me. Like, I will go to it over Google now for pretty much everything. And it's like, I've got like on my browser for work stuff and on my phone for kind of all the kind of random personal stuff. Like, how do you convert this into this? What does this mean? My laptop keeps doing this. How do I stop it doing this? And it's just like, if I can't find it online on a search engine, I will find it on ChatGPT and it'll give me actual useful options rather than having to like look through a million forums to find what I want. It's, for me, been fairly life-changing on that regard. I mean, Max, how do you use it personally? And how is your company using it?
I feel like I should have used it to try and pair my headphones before this.
100%. You definitely should have.
Giggling like an idiot.
Exactly. And this is going to supersede the YouTube video, right? No longer will you have to look at the YouTube video to work out how to fix your broken dishwasher. ChatGPT. Here we go.
I absolutely loved when Google rolled out that feature so I could search something and it took me to the right part of the video. That was like, well done, guys. You've completed the internet for me now. as a company, I spoke to a young woman team earlier who is away from work. She's a creative writer and she's awesome. She's really, really like proper creative powerhouse. And she said that she's similar to the example I used earlier about the guy I chatted to yesterday. She had used ChatGPT to help generate like email subject lines, but mostly with a view of, okay, I'm using this. I don't want to go with those ones, or I like the idea on that one. Let's build it into like the formula that we know works or that we wanted to try here. Most of them said £39 seats on the Eurostar, so I'm sorry about that.
Oh dear.
Obviously they didn't. I found, because we deal with quite a lot of international stuff here, we had a brief that came through in Mandarin and you put it in there and it translates it for you. It's great. And that's the sort of thing, like Google Translate just isn't there. It's very, very good.
Enough.
You still do get a few like choppy bits. I find like Google Translate short text, or when you use it on, I've got an Android because I'm really cool, but I've got like the Google Lens feature. So when you need to read a menu in a different language, it's like it ticks the box. But I do think that, like, yeah, we had like this full 20-page brief. We put it into ChatGPT and it spat it all out in English. So I think that's useful. I think that the other thing, like as a business, that we're finding is that sometimes, particularly with the younger generation, like, respectfully to everyone under the age of 24, where this is a little bit more innate, they're going to it and they're asking it questions, similar to the example of like replacing Google, because they don't necessarily understand, they haven't got like that experience or the history of marketing industry, advertising industry. Like, it's a great example. Last week, the Calvin Klein advert came out, and I don't think many people under the age of like 40 really would remember the original BBH, the Levi's advert. You know, he pisses in seeing these boxes. Great advert. Everyone should go and watch that. That's like an advert that will change everyone's life. But when you mention that in the office, and like people wanted to know about like other histories of, like, of Calvin Klein advertising, there isn't one web page that you can just go onto and just read like, oh, cool, yeah, why would Calvin Klein, you should put that on your website though, because you've done some great ads. But you can then go into ChatGPT and say top five like Calvin Klein adverts, and it will just tell you about all of them. So yeah, I think there's like definitely for a younger generation who are more natively using it, they can pull loads of knowledge quickly. They're not going to spend hours trawling through the internet trying to find that stuff. I was saying this also probably leads into like great TikTok content coming in the future with these GPTs, like generating scripts of TikTok content around that.
That's very, very true. And we are running out of time, but I'm interested as well, like from your client perspective, where, I mean, it was a great example about kind of the younger generation that will go to ChatGPT and ask it questions. And we know that, you know, the likes of TikTok generation have a short attention span. And they'll be, with ChatGPT and generative AI more generally becoming much more mainstream, they'll be... I've already said myself, it's pretty much replaced Google for me, and I'm nearly 40. So if it's doing it for me, what's it doing for the younger generation? Do you think that clients will now have to rethink kind of their approach to content to ensure their content is discoverable, is consumable, is still as engaging as possible? If people are going for the kind of the easier option or going straight to ChatGPT instead, how does that make your clients think about what they're putting out there?
I thinking on that, I wonder if it's going to change content ideas from clients, so that in the sense that they're going to be thinking, how do we train GPT models to like, how do we train the system to always talk about us? So if I Google, tell me the top 10 vacuum cleaners, how does Dyson always come up at number one? If I chat GPT, the top 10 vacuum cleaners, how do we make it that Dyson is always mentioned at number one? And is it going to be lots of kind of like, maybe like a new world of SEO where everyone's going to be just trying to get themselves, call themselves number one all over their site so that it trains the model.
I think that example is really interesting, right? Because isn't that the whole reason that OpenAI wanted to develop ChatGPT the way that they did? This whole notion of democratizing something, not making it buyable, purchasable, which is in effect what search became, right? And it's also one of the reasons that it's driving people from Google search to anything else that's useful. And ChatGPT is one of those things, because actually your Google search results these days is just littered with effectively search, paid search results, not organic search results. And what you're getting at the moment through ChatGPT, whether it's fully accurate or not, is arguably organic. And I was under the impression that's one of the reasons, that was one of the, you know, moral reasons behind OpenAI operating themselves the way that they do. So it'll be really interesting to see where that goes.
Totally agree. Well, on that note, we are out of time, but I want to say thank you so much to Rachel and Max for joining me today. I think that was a really interesting discussion. Thank you for joining us.
Pleasure.
Thanks very much for having me. And sorry, ASA.
Yeah, sorry, ASA. Do not, what do the kids say? Don't at me. Do not at me. thank you, guys. And thank you, as always, for listening. It's been the Meet Some Mad Tech podcast. And we will hear from you next time.